United States versus Bokhari, Mr. Albee.
Oh boy.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Craig Albee. I represent Haider Bokhari. I am making argument on behalf of both appellants in this case, Haider and Qasim Bokhari.
Okay. Now, right off the bat, so I'll get a hold on this. In their respective pleas and allocutions, what amounts, if any, did the defendants concede were involved in their offenses? I realize that one of them pled with an agreement, and the other pled without. But there was some version of the offense to which they each pled, and what was it? Because I can't, you know, I don't know what Judge Randa did here. Did he definitively use $1.2 million as the loss? At one point he says, if we use, at another point he says, with one of the defendants, with one of the other defendants, he says $16 million. I mean, I just can't get it.
I would agree that that's a very difficult problem here, is in determining exactly what Judge Randa was finding, particularly with respect to the issue of loss of the objected to enhancements. The Bokharis both conceded that they were responsible for $1.288 million loss in these cases. They objected to the $16 million. I do not believe that at any point Judge Randa found a $16 million loss. He certainly strongly suggested at Qasim's sentencing that he was using a $1.2 million figure.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like an assumption that he's working with there.
But in Haider's, that wasn't the case.
I certainly don't believe you can make as strong of pitch that he was assuming the $1.2 million when he sentenced Haider in the afternoon. But I also don't find any evidence that he was making any factual findings to support a $16 million loss. And I guess the other thing that would support the lower finding in terms of Haider's sentencing is he clearly saw these two at the same level, and given the greater clarity with which he found the loss in the morning, I think you can safely determine that he was at $1.2 million in the afternoon as well, or should have been.
And I take it that Raza is still a fugitive?
As far as I know. At the time that Judge Randa sentenced the defendants on January 28th, the Booker decision was just 2.5 weeks old. There weren't any cases from this court to guide the district courts in terms of how to apply the guidelines in the post-Booker world. There's probably limited commentary on what role the guidelines would be playing in the post-Booker world. And not surprisingly, as a result, there was considerable confusion as to the role the guidelines play. And when there's that kind of confusion, mistakes are made. And I think in this case, Judge Randa did make mistakes, and that perhaps understandable, but here it deprived the defendants of the type of sentencing that they were entitled to.
And I understand everybody was somewhat at sea, but the defendants never objected to the district court sentencing methodology. That is, didn't specifically request that he make a determination of the precise offense level or the precise amount of loss.
Well, I think the defendants were asking for that, just as the defendants in, for example, the Patel case were asking for that, when throughout the proceedings they object to those determinations and they make arguments at the sentencing hearing with, I think, the expectation that the judge is ruling on those objections. And Judge Randa runs through these and discusses them and I think makes rulings in favor of the defendants, but then all of a sudden at the end comes up with a number that it's hard to understand how he came up with this number of 27, which really, you know, because he very strongly says, I don't find role in the offense, I don't find sophisticated money laundering. It certainly suggests that he's finding the lower level loss. So I think the defendants did exactly what they're supposed to do, in which Patel says that's all they need to do, because he did not say he was adopting the pre-sentence report in its entirety or anything like that. They made their objections, and I think it's when a post-conviction attorney gets in the picture and looks at what's said, it's clear that Judge Randa just didn't follow what he was supposed to do.
Did he definitively anywhere explain why he doesn't think this is sophisticated money laundering? I mean, my goodness, it certainly seems sophisticated to me.
Well, I think he finds that it's not sophisticated. He obviously doesn't elaborate at great length as to his reasons for that finding. I do not believe it's sophisticated, although I'd say this is probably an issue for Judge Randa to resolve in the first instance. But I don't think that if somebody intent on money laundering was looking for a good, complex, sophisticated model to borrow, that this is the one that they would adopt.
Well, maybe they would, because there is at least $620,000 in Pakistan, and the government concedes that it is not going to get that money back. And it certainly seems as if Raz is there in Pakistan with a minimum of $620,000.
Well, I don't know that would, in and of itself, make this sophisticated. That simply by sending the money to somebody who's overseas, if that in itself is sophisticated, I don't know. I mean, it makes it more difficult to recover.
A lot of people would not, the ordinary criminal probably would not know how to send money overseas, say, securely. Let me ask you this, though. This really follows on Judge Rovner's question. Aren't you worried that your client might get a heavier sentence? If he were resentenced and we asked the judge to reexamine the issue of sophistication and so on,
it could
be nailed.
Particularly given what I believe the loss situation to be, enroll in the offense, and other factors here. Obviously, I'm always anxious about a client getting a harsher sentence, but I don't believe that they should or, you know, hopefully will get a harsher sentence in this particular case. Obviously,
well, you're assuming that he wins on all his, right, all his,
or perhaps
claims,
at least two,
right?
Two out of three. And perhaps that is a risk. That's something I'll have to address in the district court.
You can address it in the district court. That's too late.
Well,
you can't say to Judge Randa, well, you know, you'll have to resentence this first and you have to consider everything the Court of Appeals said, but please don't give him a higher sentence.
Well, I will say please don't give him a higher sentence. I'll ask for a lower sentence. And in fact, I just believe this should be a lower guideline range and a lower sentence.
Is your client aware of the risk?
He is.
Can you just tell me, did Qasim graduate from Stetson Law School, or was he?
I don't believe so. No. And again, as I was saying, there's certainly a great deal of confusion about the role of the guidelines with respect to Booker at the time of this sentencing. I think that's been clarified. The government concedes that the factual findings that were supposed to have been made were not made, that the calculations of the guidelines were not made, and that they should have. I think it's clear from this court's decision in George, Scott, Barrett's, and in particular Lachey, that resentencing is required. In Lachey, which was also Judge Randa, he really echoed the words he used at Hyder's sentencing of using the guidelines as guides. I think that's the term he used in both sentencings. And in Lachey, as here, he considered other relevant sentencing factors, but he simply did not resolve the objections, and resentencing was ordered by this court so that he could make factual findings and calculate the guidelines.
Now, is the issue whether intended loss is the right measure of loss, or simply whether intended loss was adequately proved?
I think before Judge Randa, the issue should be probably both.
I don't understand. Isn't the government entitled to the intended loss figure as long as it can prove it, if it's a higher figure?
Yes.
Then the question is evidence. And suppose Judge Randa found that the intended loss was $20 million. Where would that put the defendants in the guideline range?
My recollection is that $20 million adds an additional point beyond $16 million, but nobody suggested that it should be at that higher level. I believe there's not sufficient evidence that the intended loss is greater than the $7 million.
I don't understand. Why not?
Well, hopefully with the benefit of some additional evidence in the record, I believe the Beccaris at the time that they entered these contracts intended to perform some of this work. Obviously, I cannot claim
that they did. They did nothing, right?
That is true, but at the time...
So how strong is there? How likely is the judge to be convinced that they intended? And why would they? I mean, this is a fraud. Why would they do any work?
Initially, Your Honor, the fraud is to acquire the contracts fraudulently. That is, by offering improper inducements to the schools, filling out forms for the schools, that sort of thing, to get the contracts... money to begin work on the contracts. Ultimately, some things do not work out in this, scheme, but I mean their intent to do the work. Things
don't
work
out. I don't understand you. They get the contracts, then they don't do any work on the contracts.
The money doesn't come for many, many, many months. And then by the time they get the money, they're basically out of the program. They didn't expect the money to show up at that late date, and they realize nobody's looking for the work or wanting it to be performed.
Then how are they buying Porsches and houses and sending money to Pakistan?
That's
there's no money.
That's what they do after the money arrives in April 2002, when the two checks arrive in April 2002. And they make absolutely the wrong decision at that point and do everything
wrong. No, but that
wrong.
Strongly undermines your argument that they intended to do work on the contracts. Looks as if they intended to use the money for personal consumption. They were serious about doing work on the contracts, they wouldn't spend their first receipts on personal consumption, especially, you know, luxury goods, not to feed them.
That is what I'm suggesting, is that the Beccaris' intent at the time they submitted the bids on the 21 contracts was different than it was later
And you're really expecting the district judge to believe that?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Okay, good luck.
I do believe this case is like Lachey, and for that reason, the case should be remanded for resentencing. And if there's not any more questions,
you can save your time. Okay, thank you, Mr. Albee. Mr. Fredericks?
Mr. Edwards, would you just please start out? Because you argued at one point that the court definitively decided the key issue of the amount of loss. Where in the record did he do that? Because what I saw was flip-flopping and then a statement that either way, if it's 1.2 or if it's 16 million, what he said was, this is a lot of money, but where is the definitive ruling?
Sure. Good morning.
Where's the what?
The definitive ruling that it's 1.2.
There is some confusion in the record when it's taken out of context, and I will answer your question, and I'm doing that. But in light of what the arguments were about the intended loss and what the PSR said about it, it's pretty clear that that's what they definitively ruled. And I'll point you to where in the record. During the Kasim hearing on page 31 of the record, the judge says, given the structure of this operation, there wasn't any intention here really to get with the program, the E-rate program, and provide schools with the things that this program was designed to do. That's essentially saying the defendant's argument, Kasim's argument, that their intent all along, or at least at some point, was to actually do the work.
Yes, I know.
No,
but
no,
then
no.
Why did
1.2.
he say what Judge Rove did?
Just tell me the number. Where does he say, I am sentencing you on the basis of 1.2? Because, look, you know, if a court would have given the same sentence for $16 million as a court would give for $1.2 million, the court, I mean, is hardly, you know, treating the guidelines as advisory, is it? I mean, the guidelines treat those amounts very, very differently.
The guidelines treat them, I think, as a four-level difference.
Four levels.
Significant
four
in this
levels.
Case, absolutely. But what the court was saying, that they actually received $1.2 million and they intended to get $16 million, and both are very serious offenses, very serious amounts. And the fact is, that's what was driving it, not a rigid adherence, in this case, to the guidelines. The court never made an exact finding on the guidelines. Instead, he looked at the other statutory factors in particular.
Well,
what are you supposed to do? What you're supposed to do compute the guideline sentence and then explain why that's a reasonable sentence or why it's unreasonable and you're going to give another sentence. So first you do the computation, then you look at the statutory factors and decide what the sentence is.
Can you, standing here today, say that Judge Randa used for certain $1.2 million or $16
million? I can say from this record it's clear that he used $16 million. And there are two other places in the record I want to point to, Your Honor.
Oh. Okay.
That's the quote I gave you a moment ago was during the Kasim hearing, saying essentially rejecting the argument that they never intended to do the rest of the
and
work.
And just so I'm clear, that's at page 32 where he's talking even if.
Page 30.
Even if, when, you know, the transcript.
Judge 31. Page 31 is when he says they had no intention to do the things that this program
right.
was about. To
right.
Essentially
he,
saying they
yeah,
weren't going to provide
yeah.
these computers.
But when he gets to the numbers, he's saying even if we look into the assessment at 1.2 to 16 million, and later on he says, even if we use the 1.2 million, where? But Judge Rovner is asking, where is it that he says 16? That's what I'm using. That's what I'm basing it on. The words aren't there, right?
He doesn't use the word 16 million.
Right.
But
he doesn't say that's the amount.
In context of what the arguments were, he rejected the factual argument that they were making, that they didn't intend to do this work.
We understand that's what you deduce he said. He doesn't say it in here.
He doesn't use the word $16 million in the Kasim hearing. However,
if he were relying on the $16 million, what would the guidelines range be?
Right. It would be a 29, and on page 35 of that transcript, Judge Williams, he says, essentially, the court says that there is a 29 range here.
Where's 35?
Page 35 of the Kasim transcript. I think it's in the blue brief appendix.
Appendix 24 is at the bottom, is page 35.
But and that, on that page, on that
okay.
page, Your Honor, he says the range is a 29, but I'm going to give some credit for the degree of sophistication he saw here and the lack of role, and that takes it to a 26. The only way he could start at a 29 is if he finds the amount of loss, if he found it, and that's what he had done here. Then he made his what we concede is an erroneous methodology of just making a ballpark estimate and lessening the enhancement to arrive at a 26. But then he goes on and says, but because of the gravity of the offense that drives this, this court is going to impose a sentence that would be in the 70 to 87 range.
But then the rest of his language is, because the court doesn't see that 1.2 million is insignificant, you know, which that leads you to believe he's talking about 1.2. Therein lies the problem.
Mm-hmm. He provides some clarity in the Hader transcript. And this is on page 25 of Hader's transcript, which is subsequent in the appendix you're looking at.
Well, would that matter for Quasim?
Right.
I mean, what are you going to say if A's sentencing goes, if something is said in A sentencing, it travels over to B sentencing? You're not going to say that.
I'm not saying it travels, but it certainly clarifies the ambiguity.
Why should we fuss about that? Why not just send it back and say, you know, tell us what you're doing and don't engage in stream of consciousness.
And also tell us, please, give us a definitive ruling, not just on the amount of loss, but give us a definitive ruling on the role in the offense, the sophisticated means enhancements. Again, a sentence that's reasonable for a $16 million loss might not be reasonable for a $1.2 million loss. We need some key facts to begin the analysis here. We can't do it.
Well, let me first answer Judge Posner's question of why we don't just go ahead and send it back. I think it's clear on this record that this judge is going to impose a 72-month sentence regardless of whatever sentencing findings he would make under the guidelines. I think this record does make that clear. Therefore, sending it back would be a waste of time.
Now, if he thought clearly about the situation, thought through it in a disciplined way, he might change his mind.
Mm-hmm. I think in a fairly disciplined
way. You know what you're doing.
Way.
You're likelier to do the right thing, I would think.
When we had this case reach my desk, I looked at it, and we seriously considered, and I considered, doing a cross appeal because he used the wrong methodology. Because, like you suggested, with defense counsel, we could get a larger sentence because our position was 87 to 181 months or 108 months. But when we read this record, it's pretty clear to us that he's going to give a 72-month sentence, and sending it back would be a waste of time. The court's time is low
and
our time.
Yeah, well, it might help the Court of Appeals, and it might help Judge Randa the next time.
Right.
So that, you know, I mean, look, the poor man was in a position where, you know, Booker had, you know, just come down. No, none of the poor district court judges knew, you know, what was what. But we can't deal with this as it is. And you know what? The truth is there's really no good way to punish these two. I mean, at the end of all this, they're going back to Pakistan to that nice nest egg. Right?
That's right. We haven't recovered a lot of the money, and Raza remains a fugitive. But the sense
See, what you're saying, in effect, is if after the sentence, suppose the judge says nothing during the sentencing hearing, and at the end of the hearing, after listening to the lawyers, he says, I'm going to impose a sentence of 72 months, regardless.
I think
and then you say, oh, well, we know what Judge Rand is going to do. What's the point? What's the point of arguing that the guideline sentence is 108 because we know he's going to knock it down to 72?
Well, there's a good response
you
to that.
You wouldn't do that.
In that case, it would be subject to harmless error, but it would be a futile argument to argue that it's harmless error in that case.
That's completely wrong.
Yeah, because the bottom line is you don't think defendants are entitled to have a breakdown of the numbers and the rulings of the court, so they can then specifically object. I mean, that's what it really
they are entitled
I understand
to
you want us to forget that because he's going to just say 72 months. At least you hope so. But, it just troubles me that you want to just discard all the calculations, and particularly when we look at how the case law has developed since Booker's been decided.
I think you are absolutely correct. He did not do what he was supposed to do. The government doesn't think this was the right way to go about it. But Judge Rovner's suggestion that maybe he needs, or this decision will provide further instruction, I think isn't necessary. This court has provided quite a bit of instruction.
You're really off the track, far, far off the track, really off the track. Because you're saying that if a sentence is within a judge's discretion, which means basically if it's between the minimum and the maximum, then as long as we're persuaded that that's the sentence he wants to give, it doesn't matter how he reaches it. Whether he says, I'm not interested in the guidelines, I'm not interested in statutory factors, an angel appeared on my shoulder and said 72 months, and that's the sentence I'm going to give. And you say, fine, because we know that's what he's going to give. And he's send it back.
That's not the
he's
end of the analysis.
He's going to rationalize it differently. It's still going to be 72 months.
And the question is, was the error harmful? Did it affect what sentence he imposed? That's the first step. And Palladino makes this pretty clear on a slightly different issue. The second step is it a reasonable sentence? In this case, their attack is restricted to the methodology, saying it's unreasonable. They make no effort to say that this sentence on its own is unreasonable.
Yeah,
in this case,
look, if you're going to get into a lot of trouble if you persist in that position, because that position is completely wrong. Mm-hmm. You're saying the Court of Appeals makes a reasonableness assessment without considering what the judge has said. No, we're reviewing the judge to see whether what he did was reasonable. Whether what he did was reasonable depends on what he says, his explanation. Any sentence within the statutory limits is a potentially a reasonable sentence. But if the judge says, I'm giving you this 72-month sentence because 72 is divisible by 6, and that's my favorite number, right? We can't uphold that sentence, even though you could make a very good argument that if you went through loss calculation, this and that, the other thing, and all the statutory factors, 72 months would be a reasonable sentence.
Well, this is not a case where angels were whispering in ears or
well, what is it?
Vision
we don't know
six.
What it is,
is
because we can't understand his ruminations, his stream of consciousness.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as stream of consciousness. He addresses the statutory factors one at a time. Admittedly, he didn't find a sentencing range. He thought he was considering the guidelines because he made some discounting of the 29 range in light of the degree of sophistication. But keep in mind, even if Haynar...
Let me just ask you one question.
Yes.
Is this just your view of this, or is this your office's view of this? Because if it's your office's view, you're going to have some big trouble as criminal cases come up here.
Well, I have the good fortune of working for the Antitrust Division, so we have very few cases before this judge. So this is don't expect a stream from the U.S. Attorney's Office on this. But our position is harmless error applies. This judge consulted all the statutory factors, did a loose impression of the guidelines. But keep in mind, Haydar Bakari, even if he wins the point on enhancement for his role and for the sophistication, he's still at a 27 offense level, which is the ballpark figure this judge gave.
Mr. Fredericks, if I ever get in trouble, will you defend me?
Ultimately, if
why
this court...
Why did the Antitrust Division handle this case?
My understanding, I don't think this is in the record, is that there was suspicion of bid rigging in the E-rate program. They gathered data, found that with this bidder, the numbers were outrageous, investigated. Turned out there wasn't a Sherman Act violation, but at that point, they had a fraud case.
Can I just make something very clear?
Yes.
I, for one, and I think my brother and sister as well, want Judge Randa to redo this so that he can help us understand what he did.
Ultimately, if this court has...
Because I think you're the only one in the courtroom who understands.
Well, if this court has sufficient doubts that he would give the same sentence again or that it's a reasonable sentence, then you have to remand. In that case, we'll argue for another sentence.
That's not all
might have to be the outcome.
That's not all there is to it.
You keep missing. Mm-hmm. You want us to decide whether 72 months is reasonable. No, actually, you want us to decide how committed Judge Randa is to 72 months. And if we agree with you that he's committed... The fact that he may have reached that in a completely irrational way, that would be irrelevant to you, right?
Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's
like
irrational.
You didn't like my angel hypothetical, but the logic of your argument is all we have to decide is what Judge Brand is going to do on remand. And if he says nothing will make me move off 72 months, then we have to affirm. That's your position.
Mm-hmm. If 72 months is a reasonable sentence.
And then you know what? We'll be right here again.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be right there again. And this is going to be your career case. Mm-hmm. The sentencing of the two brothers. Maybe by then they'll have the third.
Maybe we'll have Ros Bakari too. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Fredericks. So, Mr. Albee, do you have anything? How much time? 2 minutes?
I'll answer any questions, but I don't have anything further.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. And our last